Hope this helps. For the day, week, month of July 24th in the year 2020, the year that's felt like 10, we are back. Hello, helpies, to help this helps. Hope this helps. We are an IT sysadmin podcast talking about anything and everything. Enterprise, Microsoft Cloud, yada, yada, yada. My name is Steve.
And my name is Tiffany.
We are glad to have y'all along again, and thank you very much for listening. This week, we got our usual various topics of moderate coherence. Little news, little rant, tips, little everything, really, in the sysadmin world. As the sysadmin world usually goes, anything can happen sometimes. So without further ado, let's get to the boot up, which are our intro topics of random and inspired, uninspired things.
All of the things.
This week, maybe last week, I didn't look at the date of this article.
One of the weeks.
One of the weeks recently between now and our previous show, Microsoft 365 is updated with new security risk compliance tools.
Woohoo!
And the highlight feature is Microsoft Endpoint Data Loss Protection, Double Key Encryption, Insider Risk Management Capabilities, and Communication Compliance Tools and Teams. This sounds really fun.
It sounds like a lot. I'm kind of overwhelmed.
Yeah, the biggest one to me sounds like Endpoint Data Loss Protection. That is kind of big.
Oh, yeah. Right? Well, I mean, yeah. I mean, tons of people are going out all over the place and losing their laptops.
So DLP previously was kind of more limited to email or cloud or the server-sided world of things, where if you deleted something and then rage quit the company, you could get it back. But endpoint-sided DLP, that is interesting, because working from home, that's made things a whole lot more important. You can blow a laptop up really much more easily at home than you could at work or somewhere.
Well, interestingly enough, I recently had run into a discussion with legal about what retention policies we had in place. It was discussed, oh, it's email, SharePoint, and they're like, oh, you guys keep laptop data, right? And we're like, wait, what? Laptop data? We have ways to wipe and do stuff with laptop data, don't we? You guys just keep that when someone leaves? So this is actually a very important piece of something or another. I don't know why I can't word it today. But this is like, I feel like legal departments have been begging for this for forever.
I think the problem was not so much the capability of doing so as much as the storage needed to do so. Because when you're talking endpoint DLP, you have a lot more things to think about, particularly on a laptop, like how much of this do you want to save? How much of it is worth saving? You know, do you really want to keep the program files folder on 3,000 laptops? Do you only care about the user profile folder? Do you care about the app data folder? What if the user saves stuff outside of the user profile folder? Like, how good are your policies for preventing people from doing that?
Yeah, and I think the biggest thing to point out here is to maintain control of the data. So a lot of times with DLP policies is to prevent things such as credit card data, and it'll encrypt that. One of the really cool things with this is now you can prevent what kind of files are shared, or, you know, before you could install like the semantic software, I forget, Vontu, oh, that was just the name of it. But their data loss protection software, and then it could stop you from using like a USB drive to copy data over. So having it all in the M365 suite is pretty nice.
Does this leverage OneDrive, I'm assuming? Probably
to some extent.
It would probably have to. You know, OneDrive already can provide DLP because the files get slurped up to the cloud.
Mm-hmm.
Based on this article, so DLP sends an alert with policy tips and guidance to remediate. Not only do you have to, you don't have to wait until something happened, it gives you proactive options as well, where it can probably preemptively scan the endpoint and tell you, someone can save things to like the C drive outside of the profile folder, which may not work in your policy, or it may not be data that is salvageable in your policy. So how do you plan to deal with that? And maybe you can roll out a GPO, or, I don't know, threaten the user with termination to not do that again, or a lot of mitigation ideas there.
Oh, yeah. A lot of preemptive and taking precautionary measures, which is really good. And then if you start seeing users really, like all of the users creating folders outside their drive or copying all their files to USB drives or to external OneDrives, is it a little bit policey? Yes. But in the remote work world, I think you kind of need some level of oversight. like that.
Other things that come to mind are like, what if you had like a personal Dropbox and you are offloading data to that? It's similar to external forwarding and exchange and wanting to curb that really fast and shutting all that down. When you think of data as emails and where do those emails go, how can you make those emails leave the company or illegally sent out of the domain it's allowed to exist in? Then you start thinking about OneDrive. You could think about other computers loading up that OneDrive that are not corporate owned. DLP can at least probably scan for or log and report on that at the very least.
Yeah, I almost wonder too, like, what happens if you keep a lot of your own not personal stuff, but like if you write your own scripts and so forth and you keep a copy in your own OneDrive or Dropbox? Where does that come into play?
That's a legal rat's nest, right?
Yeah.
There. A lot of companies have clauses stating that anything you develop on company time belongs to the company, and you cannot distribute that or use it for your own profit or your own personal, your own personal gain. You might have to talk to your legal department in terms of whether or not what you do is yours. But when you're saving it, especially to a company cloud drive, or if you're just doing it on their time, that's where it gets risky, and you need to be careful about that. I had another thought about GitHub and stuff, but it probably, and I think the more I think about it, it falls under the same guidance, though.
It's just something that you don't think about every day when you're creating something, and then you're like, oh, yeah, this is mine, but it's not really yours.
The thing I just remembered was, if you're working from home, you have a lot of downtime, and it's kind of sort of, oh man, this is tough when you have work, all this remote work. It's like, what if you have another computer next to your work laptop and you are writing something? It happens to be a script for like a separate GitHub repository. Does that technically count as company work, or is it not because you did it on a personal machine that had no connection to your work machine?
That's really risky. I think it could fall under both, depending on, so if you produce something that started making money and they found out that it was on company time.
Yeah, that is definitely the question for a department that I am not part of.
Exactly. Well, and I think a lot of times, so when I worked at the Apple Store many years ago, that was one of the things that you signed off saying that if you develop anything third party and publish it to the App Store, they own it.
Right. Exactly.
So that's where I think it has to be written in a policy saying that if you do anything that has to do with that company, or you create something in the time frame and you publish it to your own stuff and you start making a profit, I think that has to be all part of the data policy. And I don't think most legal departments even think about that.
Things to think about when you're setting up governance, DLP, and the little things like that, you might want to consult with your legal department when coming up with concrete policies for stuff like this, because remote work has definitely changed the landscape of this. When we're working in offices, it's a little bit more cut and dry with a demarcation point between home and work. But now that home is work and work is home, we have some decisions to make.
Yeah, definitely need the separation of church and state there and what those fine lines are. And I don't think, my guess is that a lot of companies haven't really determined what those are because no one expected to work from home.
That's a really good way of putting it. The separation of church and the IT deep state.
Exactly. Separation of church and state, IT government. Governance.
Yes. Oh, boy. Okay. So, wow. Now that we've officially taken this topic into strange, strange territory.
I think we've gotten a little lost here.
We've gotten a little lost here, but there's been some companies this week that have gotten more lost than us. And that company, the loser of the week is Garmin.
Ouch.
And all I have to say about Garmin is ouch.
Yeah.
Ouch. F's in the chat for Garmin.
Ouch.
So Garmin was ransomwared, to put it lightly. I don't know if it's fatal, but it's severe. They are taking multiple days to try to recover from this attack. As to how they were attacked, I don't know if they have disclosed that yet. They have been kind of mum about what caused the infection to get into their software stack. It's not looking good at the moment. It's possible it could have been social engineering. It could have been a case of no MFA enabled and someone just got in. But wow, this is rough.
Yeah, it's not good. I read something too, and I can't seem to find it again, that Garmin wasn't the only one attacked.
Unconfirmed. I read these articles this morning, and I don't have them handy at the moment, but I believe NHPR was also broken into this morning, as well as certain UK universities, whether or not they were the same virus or bad actor that got to them. I am unsure. It's been an interesting week. It's almost like all this happens simultaneously as to whether or not it's related. That's up for debate.
Well, interestingly enough, too, Emotet has been really attacking hard the past couple of weeks. And I read this article today about this dude who has been basically sabotaging them in return. He's been just basically going, like, vigilante on them and just basically poisoning their payloads. So what's interesting is I do, like, these weekly proof point calls, and they go through all the big attackers. Those are definitely some of the ones that are commonly mentioned.
Blackbaud was the attackee. They're a provider of education administration, fundraising, and financial management software.
So they were attacked.
Yes. They were a force behind parts of NHPR as well as UK universities for education administration, fundraising, and financial management software. This is interesting, but it's all kind of happened at once. Garmin was a victim of Wasted Locker, a fairly recent ransomware variant of some kind of strand. I've lost track of how many there have been at this point. The group was known as Drydex or Evil Corp, I guess. That's the group claiming responsibility for this one.
Why would you name your hacker company Evil Corp? Like, that just seems so obvious.
Because nobody is nice anymore. At least they're easy to find. You know, who did it? Evil Corp. Well, case closed.
It sounds like something out of a Powerpuff Girls episode. Or, like, in the series.
You know, back in the day, we had, what was the one from, like, 2009, 2010? They were going around. Ransomware wasn't really a thing back then. They just kind of just broke into sites and they defaced them and then went their way. But then they were eventually caught by law enforcement. It's escaping me what they were called. It was a fairly big story for a couple of months in like the summer of like 2011, 2012. It'll come to me. I'll put it in the show notes if I can remember their name.
Yeah, I feel like there was a lot that happened because that was like the Sony PlayStation hack or the Sony hack years.
Yeah, it started with like Anonymous and then like a offshoot of Anonymous and then another offshoot of Anonymous. And I remember the ringleader of one of those groups ended up becoming sort of a double agent for like the FBI or cybercrime. And he kind of got his sentence reduced because of that. But it's been so long. The names are escaping me as to who they were.
So basically what we're saying is nothing is safe. Especially working from home.
Lulzsec, that was the name. Sorry, I did a real quick Google. Yeah, it was Lulz Security or Lulzsec. That was the name of the group that was seemingly unstoppable for about a couple of months in 2011, 2012 until their ringleader Sabu was caught and then it all kind of fell apart. So I have a complaint about Teams.
Oh no, what's your complaint this week?
When do we not have complaints about Teams?
I feel like there's a weekly complaint about Teams with you.
This is one that bit me today, and it might be actually a combination of complaints, but I'll just go off script here for a little bit. Can you tell me why Teams doesn't really have a true tabbed browsing UI? If someone sends me some random document in a Teams message and they want me to review it, I can click that document and I can open it in line in Teams in the Word online, at least I think it's the Word online viewer/editor thing. But when I click it, it takes over the entirety of my Teams window. There's no pop out. It just takes over the whole window. And I might want to maybe message this person who wants me to review their document, but I can't without closing the document to message them. And then to get back into the document, I got to click the link again, which might take some time because Teams is built on Electron, which is built on Chromium, which is slow and takes up a lot of RAM to do anything.
So true.
So my question is, why doesn't Teams have a tabbed UI? Like, why does something I do take over the entire screen, and why does it take so long?
What is interesting is that it's being addressed, but not for what you're specifically complaining about. So coming in some of the updates, they're going to do pop-out meetings. So now you can actually, like, work inside of Teams while your meeting is not taking up the whole screen also. Maybe it'll come someday.
I was told by a coworker that the pop-out UI was rolled out to our org, at least for calls, but I was unable to find this setting in any of the settings panels or in an active call, weirdly enough.
Maybe. I somehow don't necessarily believe that, but maybe. I think that's coming. in August.
I don't know if he had some kind of like beta teams installed, or if he was using the web UI, because he said he was actively using it. And I don't know if he was just BSing me or if he just had two instances of the web UI open or something.
Maybe.
But it definitely wasn't a thing for me.
I know it's available in chat, but not yet for meetings, or maybe for calls, but definitely not for meetings unless they're on some pilot or on some early adopters program. I don't even think I've seen MVPs have it yet.
My question, my complaint still remains. I need teams to have better like multi-threading operations than what it's currently capable of, because not only does it get frustrating when something I click takes over the entire screen, whether it be a document or a link in the top shortcut tab section of a team or a message or a chat thread, or if it's a call that needs to pop out, or if I'm in a video chat and I need to quickly switch back to chat, everything in Teams either takes over what you're doing or does it really slowly. Sorry, I'm just complaining about Teams this week because it really bit me in the rear this week.
Well, I'm sorry about that. Hopefully someone has some sort of solutions for your problem someday.
Hopefully Microsoft.
I mean, speaking of that, this week during Inspire, they announced a whole bunch of low-code options where you can do stuff inside of Teams. So maybe. It just sounds like it's going to slow you down even more.
Great. More stuff added into Teams to slow down the experience even further. Yes, Teams apps are coming out where you can add things into Teams. Like you can integrate Ring Central into Teams, I guess. You can add all this other stuff. You can schedule, I don't know, based on this article, it looks like you can schedule entire meetings with the full UI that kind of looks similar to Outlook.
All kinds of good stuff. I mean, things that don't fix your current problems. One of the ones I want to point out is Azure Lighthouse that was announced, which is really funny because I remember a couple of, like several years ago, when Lighthouse was like an idea, they weren't ready yet to roll it out. And I just remember back in the day, we were part of the early adopters program. If you notice where you currently are, there's a tombstone that's RIP Lighthouse.
Arr, here be the Azure Lighthouse.
Arr. We tried this and it failed miserably, but it looks like it's back.
Sometimes dead things just come back.
Yeah. I mean, it looks like people have been using it, and I don't know if it's the same product than I think it was before. I sort of started ignoring Lighthouse, anything named Lighthouse, because it was such a salty project at the time.
There's a fun little thing in this new Teams meetings update. They call it the after meeting experience. And oh boy, there is nothing I want more at the end of a meeting than to somehow drag the meeting on even further after it has ended, with additional features that could keep me from just hitting the end call button, just going, ugh.
So wait, what does that mean to have an after meeting experience? Wouldn't you just keep the meeting going?
The benefit of these new meetings extensibility points is that, like today, end users will have benefit of having their apps persist within this meeting's surface to continue to use and draw back upon for further collaboration.
Oh, okay. I get it now. Because a lot of the times when you close out of a meeting, you have to go back into that meeting to access like the whiteboard and other aspects of it if you were not like the curator or the creator of it. So it sounds like you can like keep collaborating after the meeting if you need to.
Yeah, that sounds about right. So it's probably just easier access to the meeting's materials as opposed to what it currently is, where you kind of have to dig into your calendar, check your email or whatever the current setup is based on what you got.
Right, because if say you never had a chat session in the meeting, then you wouldn't have any sort of record of what went on.
When I hear after meeting experience, I kind of think of the more human experience of the after meeting experience, where, when a meeting ends, there's usually like that one person or two people that kind of pull you aside and they want to like maybe tell you their opinions about something that happened in the meeting for maybe the next 20 to 50 minutes. And you just, at that point, you're just drained. The meeting's already gone on for so long and you just want out. And when I think after meeting experience, I just think nothing but just hitting the end call button and screaming for a bit.
Oh yeah, no one wants the meeting fatigue. That's more of like, let me have my free time so I don't have to think about this anymore.
I'd rather Microsoft build in after meeting therapy rather than remind me of the meeting I was just in.
That actually sounds great. What if it's a third party app that you could just add on? That you just like it just automatically calls like a therapist.
It could be like a breathe session or just calming serene waves of the ocean.
Yeah, some ASMR.
Yeah, just pipe in some of the finest ASMR from YouTube.
I think we're onto something.
That's what I would do if I was to design a meeting experience. You know, you got to think of more of the human element, not try to extend a meeting in its soul-sucking fashion in any more than it already is.
I think that Teams needs like a hold music option where you can just, again, like pipe in that music like as the meeting begins, ends, there's just awkward silences.
And at that point, it becomes a full-on video production, really, though, if you're going to start doing music, maybe some visualizations.
So I think Teams meeting needs like some CGI, some fireworks, you know, make it a whole like TV production.
Might as well go full on flashy, crazy stuff. I'm out of words.
Yeah, no, all the things. Well, let's move on then.
Let's do the Hope This Helps Tip of the Something, a brand new recurring, maybe not so recurring series. Hopefully we'll help somebody and ring true to the namesake of our podcast. In this week's Hope This Helps Tip of the Something, tricks to remember someone's name when you are hired onto a job where you are maybe one of the very few or only sysadmins in the building, on premise, online, and you are called to do maybe anything and everything, and it might involve you frequently reaching out or going out to people's desks or calling them or video calling them, anything like that. Sometimes you just don't know their names, especially if you've been working there for maybe 3 days. Here's something you can do that can really help with that. So say you are doing something at their system. This more applies if you're there physically and they have to like walk away or something and you need them, or you got to know their name, or you got to call someone else and you got to reference them, and you're looking all around the room and you can't quite tell who this person was. They work in an office with maybe 3 other people and you're sitting at their computer. They left it unlocked and they walked away. Not the greatest security practice, but hey, sometimes they just do that. So what do? In the old days, you could have just opened the start menu and you might get their name, but there's occasionally some policies or operating systems or configurations where you may not be that lucky. So one little trick I think of is you open the C drive and you go to the users folder, you sort by date modified descending, and you look at what user's name is at the very top, and you at least get maybe an idea of their name, possibly just their last name, maybe a first initial, depending on the nomenclature of your username configuration at your org. But that's a little way to remember people's names. If you just don't have the memory committed just quite yet, and you don't really have, you're not good at names, good with names, like myself.
That's right. You could always just call them whatever you feel like calling them.
You could. You could call them you or hey.
You with the face.
But, you know, you might want to be. Sometimes you want to be a little bit personable. Occasionally, I know as sysadmins, we don't like to be, but.
Yay. Also, back to Teams. If you make a typo in your chat, you can hit the up arrow twice to fix your mistakes. Easy.
Whoa, really?
Yeah, easy editing.
Wait, so if I send a message, so this is after I've sent the message?
Yeah, so if you send the message and then you hit the up arrow twice, you can fix your mistake.
Oh, really? I'll have to try that out. So yeah, send a message, make it misspelled or whatever, hit up twice, and that will bring in just up the same exact message. Will it give me the edit UI or will it just bring up the message in the compose box?
I'm not sure exactly how it does it. I saw a couple examples, but I need to test it out, and now you've struck in my curiosity.
I've struck in lots of curiosities. Yeah. So that's interesting. Okay, that's good to know because I make lots of typos in Teams despite Spellcheck's best efforts to prevent those. It could be just because I type faster, the Teams UI is slow and doesn't catch all my keystrokes. Who knows what it is? I'm not pointing fingers at all. It's Teams. That's kind of nice that I can maybe correct my mistakes a little bit faster than I have been by clicking the little edit button and risk sending another notification to them and taking a while before they respond and be like, hey, I thought you meant this.
No, that's actually really cool. So I just tried it and it actually brings up the UI in the message with an edit box.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. It's actually built into the UI. So it's not like it's in the type of new message box. It actually has its own.
They should really have a thing where if you send a message that Spellcheck still has a word flagged as misspelled and you've already sent it, there should be a little pop-up that says, hey, you misspelled something in your last message. You can press up twice to edit it and correct
it. That's brilliant. Like, so autocorrect, but with like a, I'm not going to correct it as you hit send.
It's going to let you suffer for a little bit. It's going to let you dangle and it'll kind of gently remind you, hey, get better at spelling. Here's how you can fix this.
It's just gonna like give you a little nudge, like, hey, by the way, we're gonna send this, but you spelt all the words wrong.
I think Teams should also have a thing, an optional feature, maybe not on by default, where just like Outlook, where you can configure a delay on sending, maybe configure like a 3-second delay before you send a message so you can maybe catch those by some kind of magic.
Or if I could put like a mail tip on it or like a message tip of, hey, dum-dum, before you send this, you probably want to think about what you're saying.
That too. Teams needs a drunk mode.
Have you had too many beers today? Think again.
I don't always drink at work, but when I do, I try to send incendiary messages to everybody in my team's chat list.
That's the best. But sometimes you need a reminder like, hey, how many drinks have you had today? You might want to rethink it.
Maybe it makes you just solve simple math equations before you send messages.
Yeah, no, yeah, you have to like solve a Rubik's Cube.
I can imagine some Microsoft AI detecting like negative sentences or incendiary trollish phrases when you send it to people in Teams, and maybe a tooltip can then come up there and say, hey, you've been sending some not so nice things to this person. Would you like to maybe pause and reflect on what you are telling them and maybe think about how nice you're about to be, or maybe have it force you to solve some kind of math equation or something?
That's when the ASMR starts playing or the meditation music. So that can be not only used for meetings, but also for jerks in the workplace.
Yeah, Teams needs a jerk mode. All these kinds of quality of life improvements, Microsoft, take note, because this can really help in improving the toxicity of the work environment.
We're just trying to, you know, replace people with Teams.
That too. I mean, any kind of automation we can introduce that can correct humans in any possible way at this point, I'm all for.
Same. Let's do that. All right, Steve. Let's talk about PowerShell.
Yes, don't go breaking my heart. This week, we are going to discuss probably a practice that I bet maybe only I do that I'm guilty of. Something you can do in PowerShell functions which may be detrimental to other parts of your scripts and code if it is used incorrectly. What I am talking about specifically are the break and exit commands in PowerShell scripts and functions. What is the difference between the break and the exit command? They do similar but different things. In a script, you would use the exit command to literally quit out of the function, not the function, the script that you are working on, and it's kind of the break glass, just completely stop what I'm doing and get out of here command. Helpful for if you're writing a non-functionized script where you have reached a condition where you don't want to proceed under any circumstance and you just want to get out and return to the prompt. Exit is great for that. However, you can't really use exit inside a function, because that would be detrimental, because exit is a hard exit. It will close out of the console. It'll not only kill the function, but kill the console, and you don't exactly want to do that. Now, with break inside a function, if you call break in place of where you would put an exit in a script when you are in a function, break will basically end the function hard, but it will not close the console out. So if you ran a script where you're calling a function that contains a break, it'll kill the function, but it won't necessarily kill the script, unless the script is relying on the successful completion of that function to proceed. Now, this is helpful in a lot of situations where you don't have error handling. However, if you are using a script where you are calling multiple functions and maybe it's inside a for each that is reading a CSV, say import CSV for each line in the CSV, run this function, then do this other thing, do this other thing, do this other thing. The break statement inside a function, inside that CSV, can be catastrophic to your script if you are not careful about where it happens and when it triggers. So for example, I actually had to correct this in one of my older functions this week, where I had a compromised account function where I said, let's do a preliminary check and see if the user exists, first of all. If they do not, break the function with the break command and get out of here because we can't find the user, we don't want to proceed. That's great and all, but let's say we call that function inside another script and it's inside a for each for import CSV. Now, if we call that function and that break triggers and you're inside that for each in the CSV for each, you will break out of that iteration inside the loop, which is not good. With that condition, you need to be really careful, and you may want to not use break, but instead use a little workaround of such of sorts things that I call proceed flags. I only call them proceed flags because I just have a way of coding this in. And effectively what they are just Booleans. So in place of where you would put a break statement or a hard exit, consider this. Set a variable $proceed, maybe. At the very start of the function, you could say set proceed to true. It's always going to be true unless it gets tripped by this check part of the function. Then it sets it to false. And at the bottom, your main meat and potatoes code, you can wrap that in. If proceed equals true, do this. If not, then just do nothing. And that's kind of a helpful way of preventing functions from unexpectedly killing your scripts by incorrectly or inadvertently ending your script by use of the break command. Or if you're not using functions altogether, the exit command can be similarly disastrous to you. But that's my little tip for the break and exit commands and how they can unexpectedly kill your scripts. And if you're ever wondering why an automated task randomly quits out without much of an explanation, check your scripts for breaks and exits. And if you see them and they get tripped, maybe think about a different way of terminating your functions due to errors.
That's really insightful and good to know.
I bet it's not groundbreaking. I'm sure it's been done before. I'm sure there might even be better ways of doing this. But it's a quick fix for if you were like me, where maybe a while back you may have done things a little bit wrongly with break and exit, and you're still kind of cleaning it up here and there.
Yeah, I mean, it's not life-changing, but it's pretty important fundamentally.
The beauty of coding or scripting is being able to open up older scripts of yours and then be completely and utterly disgusted by how badly they were written. And you just look at that and you go, who wrote this trash? And then you realize it was you, but you've gotten better because of knowing that the script is trash.
That just sounds really hard on yourself.
That's the world of coding and programming.
Or you're just hard on yourself.
You could be just hard on yourself too, but hey, you know what? I like to look at it, at the glass mostly full side of things, if possible.
That's pretty good. All right, you get to go on and on now about your cloud to ground and that one time that you had to learn how to do all the things.
So I've really won the topic lottery this week. So declassified sysadmin stories, the cloud to ground, that one time Steve had to move an organization out of Office 365 to on-premise Exchange. That was a fun time. So we're probably going to start a new series in this podcast where we just kind of tell crazy old stories of jobs past where it's been declassified enough where we can kind of more comfortably tell the stories, or at least anonymize all nouns and people and whatnot to be able to tell these crazy stories. So the one I'm going to tell today is the one time I had to build an on-premise Exchange server and move a whole org out of Office 365, not into Office 365, but out of Office 365. Let's set the stage here as to what the scenario was. This organization was going out of business, but the branch we were in was not necessarily going down with the ship as fast as the main ship. Because of that, we had some things we had to shift in-house from the parent company. One of those things was email, and it was a unique situation where they had an Office 365 tenant, all the users were up there, and we had no real idea of whether or not this tenant was going to suddenly get shut off as a result of the company going under. And we knew we had to last several more months longer than what the pace of things were for the failure of the parent company. My boss comes to me and he goes, Steve, how fast can you build an Exchange 2013 server? And he goes, I mean, really fast. I kind of look at him and I go, why? And he says, well, and he explained it for the, you know, the aforementioned scenario and reasoning, saying we need to keep our email and we don't want to suddenly lose it, and that would be really bad for us. So I need you to scrounge up whatever you can from our current environment to build this Exchange server and get everyone out of the cloud and onto the server.
Wait, if I remember correctly, wasn't the parent company losing their access to the subscription, or someone had the passwords or something?
It was unclear. What we didn't have on our end, we had no admin access to this tenant. We were just residents of this tenant. The admins of this tenant were not us. They were people in the parent company. Anytime we needed something done, we had to reach out to them. And they were just gone. They were already laid off at this point. So we were stuck with a still functioning Office 365 tenant. However, we had no tools to do exports or any kind of like analytics or anything like that. We were stuck with the local clients, the local Outlook clients, and the local cached OST data. Not only that, we also had to somehow build the on-premise Exchange server and redirect our domains at the DNS level to stop going to Office 365 and come down to our theoretical server that we were building. It was a long week of planning, tearing my hair out, and trying to just theoretically think, how are we even going to do this? I started just gathering my thoughts on how to build an Exchange server, which I had never done before, especially not for a production organization. In the past, I built some theoretical Exchange servers for like some educational environments where you could just tear it down at the end of the day. But this was different. This was a real deal, like full externally available Microsoft Exchange 2013 environment. Not only that, I had to figure out how to make it work on existing hardware, which wasn't the beefiest hardware in the world, but it was sort of doable. I kind of just started researching things. We got DNS to somehow redirect. I installed Microsoft Exchange. I got a rudimentary test account somehow sending with email. And piece by piece, I got this server slowly working, which is unbelievable to me now because I don't know how half of this even worked, especially with the same domain existing both in Office 365 and on-premise and somehow getting the mail to start rerouting on-premise.
Yeah, that's impressive.
To this day, I'm not quite sure how it all worked. What I had to do was I had to get a VMware host to even host this Exchange VM. This wasn't a redundant environment. This was literally just one VM doing the entirety of Exchange on it. It had about 15 gigs of RAM free on the VMware host with maybe about a terabyte of space available. It ended up not quite being enough. I built out what I could, got it provisioned, got the users imported, and we got the mailbox, the actual on-premise mailbox is created empty, but we had to fill it with all of the data from the old tenant in Office 365. The only way we could do it with no admin tools was we had to go to everyone's computer on site, load up Outlook, let it download everything. We had to adjust the download retention settings for local, and then export a PST out of it. That took a while. We had to schedule a lot of time with a lot of people. Some folks didn't have computers there, so we had to have them log in on someone else's machine and load an Outlook profile and just load up the entirety of their mail and contacts and calendar. You name it, it had to come down locally.
What a nightmare.
Then we had to export the PST. It was a mess. It took weeks and weeks. There were checklists. We had some folks that were tough to track down. It was a complete mess. As we started rebuilding our environment locally, in this on-premise Exchange server, we encountered an issue. We were running out of disk space. And at that point, I was like, oh my God, what are we going to do? This org wasn't very cache rich, cache flush, cache anything. And a lot of times I was stuck with literally just finding hard drives in drawers or on the ground or in other servers I had to just scarf out of. The biggest and most readily available drive I could find was a USB 2.0 external hard drive. That
what? Really?
Yep. This is not made up. This was a little like a fat little like kind of, I don't even know what brand it was. It was like, it sort of had like heat vents on it and it was kind of flat and small, housing a 3.5 1 or 2 terabyte external drive. So I plugged it into the VMware host that was hosting the Exchange server and I mounted it as a disk. In Exchange, if you're doing it through VMware as a virtual interface to the VM, Exchange can't quite tell at that point if it's an external disk. So in Exchange's eyes, it was just another drive. So I mounted it as like the F drive. So that's in there. That's additional storage. I move the core mailbox database to the external drive. We now have production Exchange running off of a USB 2.0 drive going through a VMware host that is not redundant. There's no backup at this point. We're still trying to just get it to even function at this stage.
I don't even know how that worked at all.
In any other environment, this would have been considered absolutely suicidal and insane. Luckily, I only had to keep this working for about 6 months before things got better.
Yeah.
And we were able to then migrate the data elsewhere because things happened, that of which I'm not quite sure I'm at liberty to say. But in addition to, first of all, getting any of this to work, we also had to deal with some things we take for granted these days, like spam and spoofing problems. I don't know if you know this, but if you load up an on-premise Exchange server and it's available externally to the internet, by default, there's a lot of crazy stuff that happens. Folks are spoofing your domain. There's just virus-laden emails just coming in from every which way. Because, you know, at this point, in this day and age of the internet, you can just get scanned from any bot or somewhere, and they're just looking for open OpenSMTP relays or anything of the sort. They're just chomping at the bit to find servers like this. Our Exchange Box was one of those because we had no budget nor really any time or bandwidth to actually come up with any coherent anti-spam, anti-virus strategy for protecting the incoming mail that we once had in the Microsoft Office 365 environment. It was kind of crazy when I was looking back at it.
Yeah, you had a naked Exchange environment.
I remember some of the key details I was trying to recall to prevent some of these was blocking certain types of attachments via transport rules, literally just saying, we're not going to accept like 7-zip or .exe or .zip. And I just had a big long list that I had to just compile over time based on just reactionary stories I was hearing from people. Unfortunately, I couldn't be proactive with this. It was the best I could do at the time. So after that, I was trying to figure out the built-in Exchange 2013 malware scan, which supposedly downloads definitions from Windows Defender and supposedly offers something. But in my experience, that did literally almost nothing. Effectively, the most worthless antivirus I think I'd ever encountered in my life.
Definitely sounds like magic happened and you can't explain it.
We maybe limped along for a few weeks like that.
Wow.
And I remember my boss came to me and said, this is becoming such a problem. Like, we really need to do something. And he says, we have no money for this, but can you find like maybe like a 30, 60, 90 day trial of something we can install on the Exchange server to maybe limp us along? I tried a couple things. I think I made a whole list and I first like reached out to several of these vendors and I was like, do you have a trial? Can you give us anything? And only really two either replied or just had a trial available for download. The first one was called GFI Mail Essentials, and boy, did that suck. That was awful. I remember installing it for the first time. It effectively halted all incoming mail for Exchange, and I had to more or less rip it out and get the transport rules and incoming receive connectors working once again. It was just a nightmare. And at that point, I was just like, I have to get this working. I can't just let this sit this way. But at the same time, I'm stopping mail from coming in. So what do you do? After maybe a couple of days, I gave up on that idea. I was like, every time I try to install this, it just breaks incoming mail. Strike out on GFI Mail Essentials, more like GFY Mail Essentials.
Or GTFO Mail Essentials.
Yeah, whatever it is, GFI Mail Essentials, I don't like you. You're probably fine if you're like, maybe if the software is paid for and we're not using a trial, but GFI Mail Essentials, if you're listening, I did not enjoy your software. I just no thank you.
You are so upset by that.
I was literally up till 3 a.m. some mornings trying to configure that piece of garbage software.
Oh my God. I've never seen you, heard you so angry about something.
Yeah. It doesn't happen often, but man, I can, just thinking about this is... Just recalling these traumatic memories is really putting a damper on my mood right now.
You have PTSD from it.
Oh man, GFY. GFY Mail Essentials was a no-go. The one that ended up being kind of okay, at least acceptable in the sense that it didn't break the Exchange server when I installed it, was Sophos Pure Message. And that came with I believe was a 90-day trial. It was something day trial. It would at least download daily definitions, gave me some kind of dashboard, and overall seemed adequate. It wasn't amazing. Some stuff still came through, but there was a marked improvement on stopping spoofing and incoming spam, at least from blowing up everybody's inbox all the time. So it was okay. And oddly enough, I think even after the trial expired, it still somehow kept working. It didn't at least stop working. And statistically, the dashboard, I didn't notice anything ceased to function. So I don't know if it was a glitch or what, or if it was just a grace period, but it worked all the way up to the end of our time at that organization. And I'm pretty grateful for that. If you're ever in a pinch, my thumbs up goes to Sophos Pure Message. My big thumbs down goes to GFI Mail Essentials.
Thank you, Steve. I needed that story today. That was a good ending. That was really good.
Yeah, and that was a testament to the one day where it was just dropped on my desk that I had to build an Exchange server from scratch and literally do probably one of the first and only migrations out of the cloud to on-premise.
Well, I'm glad that you got to experience that because you learned a lot.
I learned a whole lot, and I hope I never have to do it again and hopefully never have to build an Exchange server that crappy ever again. Like a single non-redundant VM on a single host, running the database off of an external hard disk. Just no thank you. I never want to run that risk again.
No bueno. So, this week's That Is Accurate.
That is accurate.
Yes, maybe. Domain naming was free until 1995.
That, I believe, is accurate just from anecdotal and memory memoriam.
What? Words. So until 1995, you could just register whatever domain you wanted for free. And then some company, whom I don't really care that much about, got a sign off saying they could start charging people.
Yeah. So yeah, there was a while when I think Aaron, was it A-R-I-N? Mm-hmm. Was that it?
I think so.
Yeah. Those registrations, I think, used to be free because actually at the org that, you know, my story, that org, those domains were registered back in the day, and I believe they were free back then. They were definitely a product of that time.
Oh, here we go. In 1995, the National Science Foundation awarded a tech consulting company, Network Solutions, the ability to charge for registration. Domain prices began at $100 for a two-year registration, and then private in 1998, privatization of DNS and ICANN. So,
oh, okay.
So, good times.
Those are good times, yeah. Yeah, the early days of the internet, a lot more stuff was just kind of free, which was nicer.
Right.
To an extent.
And now you have to pay for everything. You look at something the wrong way and you have to pay.
Stuff that you couldn't even imagine that you had to pay for is now pay to play.
Right. So. It's all pay to play. Well, that is accurate. Concluding today, we're going to ask the Stiffs a question of the week, and Steve had this really good idea because we've been talking a lot about Dear Evan Hansen.
Dear Evan Hansen.
Steve's favorite musical in the entire world. Awkward pause.
Let me tell you about the awkward pauses of Dear Evan Hansen. We're not a musical podcast,
no.
But I am partially a theater person just as a hobby. And yeah, I have opinions about Dear Evan Hansen. I'm not a big fan of the musical. We're a tech podcast, right. So that's as far
as we're
going to
stay there.
That.
But what would you include in a musical about sysadmin?
Probably definitely the opening number would be something like submit a ticket or please advise.
Yes. Hope this helps.
Or something is down. Hope this helps. Maybe we can get a musical based on a podcast.
I really like this one. We've always done it this way.
That's like the end of Act One, like the pre-intermission number. It's when the main character is about to reach a breakthrough. It's like, I can revolutionize everything. I can automate so many things that took up so much of our time, free up countless hours for other projects. All I need to do is bring it to the boss and propose it. And the boss just, maybe a large, like, bass style voice. And he just shuts it all down. And he just, him and like five goons behind him, and he just goes, "We've always done it this way."
Right. I could see like a Jafar styled song rocking that one. I think that there needs to be a number called Neckbeards as well as Shadow IT Strikes Again.
Ooh, Shadow IT would be like that nice, like maybe second act, like middle of the second act. One of the other villains, maybe it's like a department, it could be like sales or advertising.
Yeah, they need like a reprise too.
It's like some other dude who's like not in IT, and he's like, "No, I run this town. You can't take this away from
right,
me."
Almost like a sheriff cowboy, like, or a duel.
My Google Drive versus your OneDrive.
Yeah, it could be like an epic rap battle. I've watched too much Hamilton.
Yeah, that's. I was thinking the same thing.
I'm just saying, it would be kind of fun.
Instead of the 10 dual commandments, it's like the 10 cloud provider commandments.
Right. The 10 shadow IT commandments.
I'd love to just see a number about Salesforce.
Oh my god, Salesforce the musical.
Oh, don't give them any ideas. I bet they're already doing it.
They have it in production. The engineering team is on it.
Oh god. No.
Anyways, so that's the answers to the question of the week. Clearly we've had way too much fun with that one. And that concludes this week's episode of Hope This Helps.
Yeah, I think... Yeah, I'm done this week.
Is more like this podcast.
Luckily it is, because we're recording this on a Friday.
Yeah, it's Friday. Anyways, I don't own the rights to that song. That is this week's Hope This Helps. Today is Friday, July 24th. I almost said the 20th. And I don't know what day of the week it is anymore. And you can rate us on iTunes, Hope This Helps the podcast, and hghpc.com, where you can listen to us chat about other stuff. We are 22 episodes in, and you'll hear from us again next week.
Yes, check us out. Give us a follow. Give us a like, tweet, interact with us. Anything you want, subscribe, send us hate mail. I don't care. So interact is the message of the week.
It doesn't matter anymore.
But I think that about wraps it up. So I think from here on out, until next week, until next time we meet, we hope this helps.
Bye.
Bye.